Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Val.
I'm going to start off by just telling you something about cognitive dissonance. We've written it up, well, Rex wrote it. Rex came with me to help me set up, and so he kind of wrote it on the board because I can't write on the board. I can't write straight. I always go uphill, and his writing's better than mine. So I just want us to sort of have this as a background to what I'm talking about. So sometimes people hold a core belief that is very strong. When they are presented with evidence that works against that belief, the new evidence cannot be accepted. It would create a feeling that is extremely uncomfortable called cognitive dissonance. Because it is so important to protect the core belief, they will rationalise, ignore, and even deny anything that doesn't fit in with the core belief. Now, I know a lot of people like this. And to a certain extent, it also applies to me. I can see me in there. Now, the writer of that was Franz Fanon. I collect all these. I see them and I think I've got to write that down. It's so good. It's so interesting. And so there's also another one that I wanted to share with you. It is crucial for religious believers to recognise that the ways they have thought about God in the past are intimately entwined with the way the world understood in the past. And I think that's very true too. That's James McGrath. I don't know who James McGrath is. I think I've heard of Franz Fanon. I think he might be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, something like that. Okay, I might get you, Joan, to come up now and read from Luke 8 for us.
Luke chapter 8, commencing at verse 26. They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged him repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into them, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him.
Thanks, Joan. Actually, I'll just that piece of music. That's all right. It's just that I just saw something in it. Now where is it? I've lost it again. Oh yes, reclothe us in our rightful mind. It's quite relevant, isn't it? Because Legion was reclothed. He was clothed and sitting in his right mind at the end. And there it is. So reclothe us in our rightful mind is, you know, very, very relevant, isn't it, this morning? Now the reason I spoke about this cognitive dissonance is when I was a young girl, coming through the Christadelphian Sunday School, I was told never to approach the Bible with preconceived ideas. And so, well, that was sort of drummed into me. You mustn't have preconceived ideas. So now that I'm an old girl, I find that I can't approach the Bible without the preconceived ideas I learnt in the Christadelphian Sunday School. So,
done a good job of abandoning.
I have abandoned some of them, yes. Okay, so I don't think we can consider the story of Legion without also considering demonology, can we? So who thinks Legion was suffering from some kind of mental illness? Everyone?
Yes.
So who thinks Legion was demon possessed?
The difference.
What's
the difference?
Sorry?
What's the demon?
Okay, so I'm just asking the question. You weren't supposed to ask questions. All right, we'll get to that later. Well, at the time, oh, here's another question. At the time of Christ and the disciples, would it be correct to say there was a universal belief that sickness was caused by demon possession? Would you agree or disagree? This is like these people that ring you up and poll you and say, would you agree or disagree? Okay.
No.
You question that?
Yes.
You don't think it was okay, all right.
People think it was just by sinning, by something it was done wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So remnants of superstitious beliefs come down to us via our language, ideas of demon possession. Some examples in the English language that I thought of was, whatever possessed you to do such a thing? This child is possessed. This child has an imp of naughtiness. He must face his demons. You look as though you've seen a ghost. One of the things that I never knew about, my mother used to always come home and say, oh, it was like bedlam out there. I never knew what bedlam, I didn't ever know that bedlam was an actual place until I read about it later on. To me, when somebody mentioned bedlam, I just thought it was a lot of noise and confusion and all that sort of thing. I didn't know that it was an actual place. So, oh really?
Yes.
Oh yes.
Yeah, very, very famous.
Yeah, where they put the mentally afflicted. Yeah, it was an actual place, and I never knew that. Now.
And you also know, Val, that they had certain times of bedlam for the people to go and see the mentally ill. You know, you could line up at the fences, and you know, in
oh,
there,
really?
There, yeah. what are you doing here? It's not time yet for you to torment me. Maybe they used to go out for an afternoon's entertainment and persecute the people, these mentally ill people like Legion.
Yeah, there was another explanation for that.
Okay.
I've got that in my mind. Okay. Yeah, well, yes, it was. It was. Yeah, it was notorious. Was it notorious for being?
Actually, an article of Bethlehem, referring to the Hospital of St Mary of Bethlehem in London, used as an asylum for these things. That's what Bethlehem means.
Yeah.
That's sad that it came from that word.
It is sad, isn't it?
That's
yeah.
Really sad. That
has to be in 1800s or something.
Yeah, it was.
I used to also use that expression, dressed. I'm dressed and in my right mind. I used to say that, and I never ever knew the connotation. I never knew until later that that came from the Bible. There's all sorts of things that come from the Bible that, you know, you don't, you sometimes later on you meet them, you know, and it's really interesting. As our language progresses, the words lunatic and lunatic asylum, bedlam, etc. are slowly disappearing. And today we're familiar with the many terms relating to mental illness, such as bipolar, clinical depression, manic depression, schizophrenia, even multiple personality disorders, which seems to describe Legion, the multiple personality disorder, doesn't it? And we know that epilepsy can cause seizures and foaming of the mouth, as do brain tumours. Today we live in an enlightened society, don't we? Therefore, I was very surprised to read in the Good Weekend in February that Bev gave me that exorcism is on the rise worldwide, backed by Pope Francis. Last June, the Vatican formally recognised the International Association of Exorcists, a group of 250 priests in 30 countries, co-founded by Italian priest Gabriel Amor, who claims to have personally rid the world of 160,000 demons. A spokesman for the association warned in October, an extraordinary increase in demonic activity, citing the apparent growth in satanic groups and occult practices. So that's what our enlightened society is concerned with.
Why is the Catholic Church backing that? They have forever been.
I understand why, and this is like, for money, perhaps. No, it's actually, it's not always a dramatic thing. I mean, they might just play over someone, and, you know, I mean, they do it, and they get psychologically for some people if they feel, I don't find it altogether to be dismissed.
It can be actually,
I think,
it's a release of information or something.
Mm. Well, if we knew somebody that was like that, we would pray for them.
Yeah. They just give it that name, you know, they are
religious. It just wouldn't be official, kind of.
They go further than that. I've actually got the article, if anyone wants to read it. There's a lot, well, the Catholic Church goes a lot further than that. But anyway. Right, the story of Legion. The disciples have just witnessed the miracle of Jesus stilling the storm. They are now sailing toward a different kind of storm. This encounter was always going to be different from our last presentation that Kerry gave us. That was a much more gentle kind of confrontation. The eastern shore of the lake was designated Galilee of the Gentiles, having been settled by ex-servicemen from the army of Alexander the Great. The setting was stark and inhospitable, a former burial place, and the man legion is described as fierce, violent and homicidal. He roamed around naked, howling and crying and battering himself. Matthew mentions two possessed with devils, Mark and Luke only one. Apparently Matthew makes several duplications in his records. It is suggested these are signs that in his gospel he was seeking to commend to his Jewish readers the acceptance of Gentiles along with Jews into the community of the Messiah. Some significant points which stood out to me at first glance. His nakedness. Later on, dressed and in his right mind. In Revelation 3:14, Laodicea is described as naked and told to go and get white clothes to wear. That also brought to my mind the covering, the wedding garment. His name, Legion, he believed and spoke as if inhabited by hundreds of demons. He identified with Rome and Roman oppression. Swine, unclean animals to be avoided by Jews. He lived among the tombs. Jesus referred to the rule of Israel as whited sepulchres. They were just a few things that stood out at first glance. Whilst Legion, symbolic of Israel, was this miracle a sign to Israel? There is a suggested parallel between the demonic and Israel needing Jesus to restore the nation to sanity. Isaiah 65:24 talks about who sit among the graves, who eat the flesh of pigs, crying and cutting with stones reminds us of Jezebel's priest of Baal, a figure of Israel in apostasy. And the word abyss is used in Isaiah 63:13, also Psalm 106:9-11, about Israel's passage through the Red Sea. As Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore, so also Legion saw the symbols of his suffering destroyed. When I looked up the word abyss, it refers you to Revelation 9:1, and it's described as a place of confinement for evil spirits and for Satan. That's the commentators for you. So we now need to address the question of why Jesus and his followers seem content to leave existing ideas about demons uncorrected. This leads us to a consideration of the accommodation theory. Does anybody know about the accommodation theory? When I was looking on the internet on Christadelphians Worldwide, I came across a conversation between a man called Tom Farah and Janine Henning about this very subject, and it was around about the time that I volunteered to do this. And I thought, oh, goodo. And Tom Farah did an assessment of the accommodation theory of demon possession and exorcism in the Synoptic Gospels. So a surface reading of the Synoptic Gospels gives the impression that Jesus, the disciples and the narrator all share the belief of their contemporaries in the reality of demons. There are, broadly speaking, three theories offered to explain this impression. The first two theories, which I'll refer to as the reality theory and the error theory, agree that all is as it seems. Jesus, the disciples and the synoptic writers did actually believe in demons. Proponents of the reality theory claim that they were correct in this belief. Proponents of the error theory claim they were mistaken. The third theory, the accommodation theory, claims that all is not as it seems. Jesus, the disciples, and the synoptic writers did not believe in demons. They used the language and terminology of demon possession and exorcism, either because there were no other words to describe these phenomena or because it wasn't a priority for them to correct these misconceptions. Or they used it ironically, with the intention of correcting their contemporaries' beliefs about demons. No one seems to accept this idea.
Yeah.
It is only among those who disbelieve in demons but have a very high view of Scripture that the accommodation theory remains popular. The Christadelphians are an example of a group with such beliefs. They have always subscribed to some kind of accommodation theory or other. So he says, today, according to Tom Farrar, the majority of New Testament scholars agree that Jesus, his earliest followers, and the synoptic evangelists all shared a real belief in demons and exorcism. So, okay, the last bit. Today, and it's not just according to him, it's according to other writers, the majority of New Testament scholars agree that Jesus, his earliest followers, and the synoptic evangelists all shared a real belief in demons and exorcism. That's what he says. I'm going to give you quite a lot of opinions. So, however, now I got out my copy of the studies in the Gospel, page 117. And this is Harry Whittaker, a very respected Christadelphian writer. And we read there, in a marked majority of instances, alongside the mention of demons, the Gospels also provide a plain, simple, matter-of-fact diagnosis of the disabilities Jesus healed. A list of them somewhere. Was that the one? It might be. No, it might be the other one. Yeah, I've lost my list. Oh yeah, here we are. A dumb man possessed with a devil, that's in Matthew. One possessed with a devil blind and dumb. And have mercy on my son, for he is epileptic. Which is interesting, isn't it? They knew the word epileptic then.
You don't know what was translated.
Surely.
I have no idea what the word was.
No. Oh dear. And a woman who was bowed together. Okay. So. Yes. So let it be clearly understood, he says, then, that in most cases, the maladies from which these unfortunates suffered were clearly recognised and described. Mention of demons could be omitted without any loss of intelligibility. Indeed, there might well be a gain in lucidity. Thus, the problem of demon terminology becomes more acute than ever. Now, He concludes. Oh no, I won't do that yet. He then gives an explanation. He takes us down a different path to try and understand this, and he gives an explanation of the Bible's teaching about angels of evil, which I found terribly hard to follow. So I'll read some of it out to you, and I hope you can explain it to me. What it says, why did Jesus so often go out of his way to talk about and to demons as though he firmly believed in their existence? So he goes off then at a tangent to explore the Bible's teaching about angels of evil. And he says the following, and this, it's funny, isn't it? This is really old-fashioned language. He would have written
20
it.
Maybe
30, do you reckon? Yeah. And it's so stilted and old-fashioned
compared to what
we now read and to the way we now speak. So he says, the angels, all of them are God's ministers. They exist to do his will. His will very often involves what men construe as evil, although when seen from God's point of view, it is precisely what he wants to happen. I make peace and I create evil. That's translated differently in the NIV. I, the Lord, do all these things. That's Isaiah 45:7. Shall there be evil in a city and the Lord has not done it? God is the controller of everything in this world. He originates all the evil circumstances in it as well as the good. It follows that whatever evil he decrees is contrived by the angels to whom his work is committed. The Bible refers to these as evil angels or angels of evil. Let it be clearly understood, these are not wicked angels. There are no wicked angels. They are God's ministers fulfilling his will, being responsible for bringing what men interpret as evil into human experience. A long list of illustrated Bible passages is available. And he cites the plagues in Egypt, and there's a protecting angel and a destroying angel, the Passover. David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel that smote the people. The angel of the Lord smote Herod. And especially germane to this study is Samuel. But the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. So in the light of this teaching, it's evident that the various maladies which Jesus healed were there in the afflicted people by the will of God and under the contrivance and control of his angels of evil. So there's a lot to think about there, isn't there?
I reckon it all makes sense. We just don't like the term evil. Just changes it a bit when you use that, but all that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That they have to do good and they have to do bad things.
Yes. Then he goes on to say, here also is the explanation of why the Lord addressed himself directly to the unclean spirit, as in Mark 1:25. Hold thy peace and come out of him. As Son of God, he had authority over the angel of evil, who was responsible under God for the distress and suffering of the afflicted creature before him. The command, come out of him, was an instruction to this angel to let go the sufferer from the dominance and control which had been exercised over him hitherto. You'll see what I mean about the language. It's hard. So, then he goes on to say, seen in this light, the sharp contrast between the profusion of demonic detail in the New Testament and their non-appearance in the Old Testament ceases to perplex. Angels of evil in the Old Testament and demons in the New Testament fulfill the same essential functions. They are two ways of saying the same thing. With such a view, a difficult problem now available, the threadbare and quite inadequate accommodation theory may be safely let go. So apparently some Christadelphian writers believe in the accommodation theory, others discount
it. Could you just tell us again what the accommodation theory?
That
accommodation theory isn't what I thought it was.
Well, I guess you'd say that Jesus accommodated their belief.
Well, that's what I thought. But the one you actually read out, the Christadelphian belief, what was that? It was a bit more.
Well, the disciple. Oh, okay. The accommodation theory claims that all is not as it seems. Jesus, the disciples, and the writers did not believe in demons, but they used the language and terminology of demon possession, either because there were no other words to describe them, the phenomena, or because it wasn't a priority for them to correct these misconceptions.
I've heard that said, Greg, you said, the adamant about that. That it just didn't matter. Jesus had so much other stuff to get through and to teach people in 3 years that things like those sort of details just didn't matter, and he used the language to help the people to understand. I just like that last bit that they were about equating angels of the Old Testament equals demons. Demons always did awful things. Always, didn't they?
Deep. Well, look, I'm about to read you.
How do we accommodate elderly people with dementia? Don't we? It's just somebody with dementia, and they're saying,
"Oh, you've got
mother used to say, John's gone out to saddle up the horse because we're going on the sulky into town now," and you accommodate that and say, "Oh, well."
Conversation.
Can I say you accommodate anybody who has anything to do with people who have dementia would understand that.
Can I just make a comment that may be completely irrelevant, but I'm just contributing it as like thinking out loud. And as you're talking, it strikes me very much that Jesus always taught in parables. That was his teaching strategy. And he gave, like, even the rich man and Lazarus, where he talked about stuff that we wouldn't say was valid, a reality. But in the parable, it was to teach something. And he, only except when he explained the parable to Sower, he didn't explain the parable. The parables were given, like an artist paints a work, that you had to look at it, to think about it, and ask God's help to understand it. So, I think one of the difficulties that Christendom, including our community, has is that we're very literal. And Jesus' whole teaching was based on a parable, but with the idea of teaching something other than what the words are really saying. So I don't think we have a problem with this kind of terminology.
No, because...
If anybody had a problem, they'd say, well, how come you talk to him like that? And then maybe he would explain it. But he doesn't. The parables aren't actually laid out for us. We're supposed to think about it and not be so literal.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether or not this kind of terminology, as Dan ever said, you know, it didn't enough to explain this stuff. It just... wasn't to be taken, it understood the way, I always say, if you look at the character of God as a benchmark, that's the way to work out whether something's valid or invalid. I think that's just what I was wanting to throw into the
point. Thank you.
Do you think because of our core beliefs that we want to hang on to, we have a problem with anything like the disorder?
We have
a much bigger problem with this than most other religions, I think.
Yeah.
Because we're thinking it might be saying things that we don't believe.
Oh, absolutely. Because the thing is, I came to all this, and my mind, and I'm a born cynic as well, my mind said, always, and no such thing as devils, demons, Satan, and I haven't thought about any of this stuff for years, because I didn't believe any of it, and I thought it was all, I had it all done and dusted. I mean, so therefore I never think about it. But then, if you get someone like Susie, who's coming to our conversational English class, I know that she reads her Bible, but she's very literal, you know. We haven't had any.
Well, you don't deny it. Just
no,
roll with it.
Yes, I know. But I mean,
that's the mixes I got with that gorgeous lady.
As Christadelphians, we were always, if you mentioned devil, Satan, demon, we'd bristle, wouldn't we? And sort of say, oh, no, this, you know, we can't have that. Anyway, I found Harry Whittaker quite difficult to follow. So then I downloaded this stuff off the internet. No, it's Duncan Heaster. And I find Duncan Heaster in the flesh very hard to listen to, because he's got a strong accent and he talks really fast, and I told him this too, so but he's not going to do anything about it, I don't think. But his writing is just so clear and logical, and I love logic. I really do. And so I downloaded, and I thought, well, what's he got to say?
Yeah.
Legion and the Gadarene Pigs. So, he's saying, in considering this passage, let's bear in mind some conclusion reached elsewhere. The Bible uses the language of the day, speaking of some things as they appeared in the eyes of their first audience. So these are other writings of his, the language of the day, and God adopts a human perspective, so they'd probably be good to read. Casting out demons is a way of saying that mental illness had been cured. See, demons and sickness. Demons in the first century were understood to be demigods responsible for illness. They are paralleled with idols, and we are assured that demons, idols have no ultimate power or existence. So he's obviously written a paper on demons and idols. These principles enable us to understand the passage as an account of the healing of a mentally disturbed man, albeit written in the language of the day, from the perspective and worldview of those who first saw the miracle. The following comments hopefully assist in clarifying this interpretation. Mark 5:2 describes Legion as a man with an unclean spirit. He cried out. But when we meet a similar situation in Acts 8:7, because of unclean spirits crying out, the Eastern Aramaic text reads, those who were mentally afflicted cried out. This is because, according to George Lancer, unclean spirits is an Aramaic term used to describe lunatics. It should be noted that Lancer was a native Aramaic speaker with a fine understanding of Aramaic terms. He grew up in a remote part of Kurdistan, which had maintained the Aramaic language almost unchanged since the time of Jesus. It's significant that Lancer's extensive writings indicate that he failed to see in the teachings of Jesus and Paul any support for the popular conception of the devil and demons. He insisted that the Semitic and Aramaic terms used by them have been misunderstood by Western readers and misused in order to lend support for their conception of a personal devil and demon. So that was interesting also. I'll go back to here. Now, when I gave some of this to Rex to read, and he said, "Well, this doesn't answer my question." And I said, "Well, what was the question?" And he said, "I don't understand." And Harry Whittaker addressed this too. "Don't understand why the pigs had to be destroyed. Seemed to be a terrible waste of..." That's right, pork. Okay. Of course, he said, Harry Whittaker said, there is a moral problem here because Jesus was causing the destruction of other people's property. I never thought of that. Did you ever think of that?
Well, they
were
just precisely annoyed,
weren't
they?
Well, yes. Absolutely. also, Harry Whittaker also put the proposition that maybe if Legion had once been a person of consequence, the pigs could have belonged to him. Yes. That's just another. It's just another thought.
Her name really low. Reasons for that. Jews shouldn't have kept pigs.
Oh, yeah, well, that was the other thing. They were unclean. But according to a lot of what I've been reading, those pigs were destined for the tables of a Roman garrison.
Oh.
They weren't there for the Jewish people to...
Well, the Jewish people would be...
nurturing them, looking after
and looking after
the
making the money.
Yeah. Oh dear.
Well, actually, now I've never heard of this, and I thought this was really interesting. So he says, Duncan says, I don't know who the man is. He mentioned someone called Steve Keating, pointed out to me that the madness may have been an infection in the brain of the trichina parasite commonly found infecting the muscles of pigs,
yes,
and transmissible to humans in undercooked pork.
Oh.
The infected man would likely have been forced by poverty to eat this kind of food and likely associated his problem with it because of the prohibition of pork under the Mosaic law. This approach is confirmed by medical observations such as the following. Neurocysticercosis is the most common parasitic disease in the world, which affects the central nervous system. A 25-year-old illiterate married Hindu male presented with a 3-month history of gradual change in behaviour in the form of irrelevant talk. On mental status examination, he was well oriented to time, place and person, cooperative, communicative and responded well to questions asked. Delusions of persecution and reference were present. He accepted the illness but attributed the cause to evil spirits. His pathology report of subcutaneous nodule confirmed the diagnosis of cysticercosis cellulite. Significant improvement in psychiatric systems was also observed following the administration of an antiparasitic drug. Delusions of persecution and delusions of reference were not found on mental status examination. Insight also improved. Instead of attributing the illness to evil spirits, the patient accepted having a physical illness. So that was it in a journal. And so also, the desire to see the disease return to the herds of swine probably stemmed from a need to know that his affliction had been cured in a rather permanent sort of way. So it would appear that Legion's affliction was intermittent. And when you were saying about the torment, have you come to torment us before your time? I think I read that the Jews thought that when Messiah came, they would be able to torment the people like the Romans and they had this idea that they could avenge themselves.
I like the Bedlam idea. You know, everyone going out 3 o'clock trying to go and torture and terrorise the mad people.
That is it, Roman. Wait a minute. Did you know that there were Romans living in that area?
No.
Well, in strange legions, is he Roman or is he Jewish?
No. Well, he identified so much with the Romans. And I don't know that he called himself Legion or whether the people around about did, because he had a legion of spirits.
Seeing the pigs were involved, I was just thinking maybe he was one of the people who lived in the garrison.
No, but he identified. And I think that he, in his mind, oh, this is just what I think, in his mind, he knew that Jews were to have nothing to do with pork. And I think maybe he had a connection. He thought that maybe his problem... Well, why did he want the evil to go into the pigs? Like, you know, he...
No, wasn't it the devils asked him to ask Jesus to put them into the pigs?
Yes,
and that's the multiple voices, the multiple...
Yeah, but it was really legion, wasn't it?
Not really.
Parallel,
not really, because he had a husband. He had a dozen people in his head.
Yeah, yeah. But his ideas are amongst all that, aren't they? Mm-hmm. His, you know...
his person.
Yeah.
But Jesus asked him what his name was, and he said Legion.
He said Legion. No, but he'd been given that name a long time ago, hadn't he? Does it say any... Have you got... Yeah, I know Jesus asked him, but he had been called
Legion.
Yeah. He said Legion. Yeah, he said Legion. Oh, look, there was something about the name and about how Jesus asked him his name for a certain reason. And I think Duncan goes into that. There's so many references. What is your name? Yeah. Okay. This is he's also saying how Legion was identified with Israel. Like Israel were a people which remain among the tombs and lodge in the monuments. Like Legion. He was always in the mountains, the high places where Israel sinned. The man's name, Legion, suggests he was under the ownership of Rome. The miracle occurred in Gentile territory, suggesting Judah in the Gentile-dominated world. What is your name? Is the same question asked of Jacob. Legion's comment that we are many is identical to the words of Ezra 33:24 about Israel. Son of man, they that inhabit those wastes of the land of Israel speak. Well, I can't see how this is relevant.
What does Laura say? Legion means?
I've never read anything to say that he was Roman.
What did it say?
Well, then he's told to go back home, isn't he, and tell the people what had happened to him. So
didn't he just say that it did say he was the Roman under the
It said, I've lost it now.
Do you know what it's got to do with
was a standing up and I had a cow disease.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know what I said?
I affect humans.
Do you know what I said to Rex? I can understand why they had to be destroyed. I mean, we don't know that. That's only a supposition. But did any of you ever watch Heartbeat? And did you ever watch the one about the foot and mouth disease where all the herds had to be destroyed? Which is terribly sad, but it's the only way of wiping. And also, this very week, bird flu has broken out somewhere. And it's in America somewhere, and they have to destroy millions of birds. So, okay. Well, I'm sort of going over my time here. I might just finish off. I've just got one.
Basically, that we're far too literal in all our interpretations and our approach to everything. And why it's difficult for us to leave behind that and go into the Hebraic milieu, which is quite a different way of looking at everything.
Well,
it's not just language, it's culture and the way of thinking and everything
is that we
have trouble with.
Yes.
We want to make everything literal and we want to understand
everything. But we're sort of coming out of that, aren't we? In this encounter, it seems to be terribly symbolic. Well, you know, it seems to be symbolic of Israel, doesn't it? Needing to be healed of their madness. Yeah. I hear many voices in my head. I see the sights that dazzle. I hear the tempting sound, but I also hear the voice of reason and logic and of my conscience, and I hear the voice of Jesus. Now, James 1 verse 13 gives us some balance to our confusion. I'm sure you all know James 1 verse 13. We're all tempted when we've drawn away by our own lusts and enticed. And Paul enlightens us further regarding our nature in Romans 7:17-20, where the good that we would, we do not, and that which we would not, that we do. Now, I mentioned the internet conversation that I read between these two people. And I thought some of their comments were very good, and I have permission from both of them to quote from this material. Tom Farrar, who is obviously leaning in one direction, he says this: I don't think there's any question that this subject matters, because it has direct consequences for how we deal with cases of alleged demon possession when they arise. Is there a place for exorcism in the 21st century church? Moreover, in the Christadelphian community, there has been a great deal of hubris over the last 150 years, condemning people who believe in Satan and demons as apostate. If these beliefs were in fact held by Jesus and the early church, then these accusations are totally unjustified. I've got a feeling that this man lives in somewhere, maybe it's Africa, you've remembered now, where it might be a very big problem, people. So that's probably why he's written this.
I think he's about 32. The other point, a young man.
Well, now this is Janine Henning, who is a very interesting person with a very good knowledge of Bible matters. And she says, I don't see a problem with disciples and gospel writers believing in demons and explaining what they heard or saw in those terms. The Bible contains plenty of cultural idiosyncrasies to make me feel comfortable about it containing information which isn't true for all time, but true for that point of time. So in that regard, I prefer to accept those beliefs were real rather than the accommodation theory you mentioned. As for Jesus, I am much more hesitant to state a position. Jesus definitely had a higher understanding than his disciples. If I consider that Jesus had a fuller knowledge of how humans thought, reading the intents of people he interacted with, and relying on his Father to reveal all things, then I'm inclined to think he knew more than he let on. How much he knew, however, I cannot say. It's not a challenge for me to consider that Jesus spoke in terms of what people would understand, whether he personally believed it or not. So I suppose, in that sense, I'm more comfortable with an accommodation in Jesus' case. Then she goes on to say something that I've thought about for a long time. Sometimes our pursuit of truth has resulted in arrogant, obnoxious and superior attitudes of, I'm right, you're wrong. You won't be saved because you believe. I now realise that this is just an immature approach to the faith life, and should be shed as we grow in our Lord. The older I get, the more I can live with diversity. Yes, I will engage on topics and put forward what makes sense to me at any given point, but love-driven action is more important. This comment struck a chord with me and helped to crystallise my thoughts. Jesus did not condemn people for wrong beliefs, did he? But for wrong behaviour. I also believe that the disciples had full understanding after receiving the Holy Spirit. And people are not condemned for not having complete understanding. For truly now we see through a glass darkly. Just one question that I've been thinking of all the way through this, that these people that Jesus and the disciples dealt with, they were baptised and they were fellowshipped and they had all these funny beliefs. So, you know, what's different now? Well, you know, why can't we fellowship people without sort of standing them up and saying, well, grilling, I suppose. Virtually you grill them, don't you? But I think we could be more, accommodating. Good word. Accommodating, yeah.
We have to first fellowship each other, let alone anybody else.
Yeah. Sorry?
Yeah, we have to first fellowship each other, let alone anybody else.
Oh, yeah.
It's better doing it in our own community.
Yeah, well.
Okay. That last little bit she said, I had in my prayer that, like, for years I've been angry with people in this ecclesia because they won't broaden their. Until one night Max Bourne said to us all, you know, you're all in the kingdom, you're all praying to God to accept you, and there beside you is, you know, Mary Brown, who you won't speak to because she doesn't think like you do. It's not important. It's love, like Janine Hennings said, it's love for each other.
Mm.
And that's the true Christ-like.
Oh yeah, I think we're all agreed on that, aren't we?
Well, I'm hopeful that we all improve, or we are improving and be more accepting.
I think we are. Okay. That's it for me.